Students and teachers across the globe have adapted to online education, but what's it like in Mosul, Iraq, a city liberated from the Islamic State just 3 years ago?
Oh my God, don't get me started. I mean, the internet here really sucks.
Also, an Iranian athlete committed a crime. He posted an online video of himself kissing his girlfriend. Now, Iranian authorities are making an example of him.
They're worried that losing this battle would ultimately mean more concessions.
And
hockey is back.
The puck drops soon on the NHL season, but only up in Canada. I'm Carol Hills. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. This is an anxious time for parents of school-aged children. Fall is a big question mark. Will schools be open? Classes online? Or a hybrid, perhaps? It's tough planning right now. Well, imagine being a parent, student, or teacher in Mosul, Iraq. That city in northern Iraq was liberated from the Islamic State 3 years ago. Here's The World's Shirin Jafari.
Abdullah Thayer was in high school when the Islamic State took over. Trucks full of men with guns rolled into Mosul, carrying the black and white flag of ISIS and flashing the victory sign. For the next 3 years, Abdullah had no choice but to stay home. Like the thousands of other Mosul residents, he was stuck living in the so-called Islamic State Caliphate, run by a brutal extremist group.
It was like living under a prison.
ISIS showed no mercy. It carried out mass executions, paraded the accused in the streets as a lesson to anyone who might be contemplating the slightest form of dissent. Normal education, Abdullah says, completely stopped. But he managed to do something that helped keep him sane during those dark days.
In the first of ISIS occupation, it didn't cut the internet. So I downloaded almost thousands of PDF books and started working on some skills. I also love reading novels and such books.
Works by Dostoevsky, the Russian novelist, German philosophers like Friedrich Nietzsche and Arthur Schopenhauer.
I didn't read philosophy before ISIS occupation. I found it applied in the situation in Mosul. When the people who got power rule the people who are vulnerable.
He read them all in English, the language he loved since he was a kid. In 2016, Iraqi and American forces began an operation to retake Mosul from the Islamic State. Fighting got intense.
During the liberation battles, a car bombed just in front of my house.
It exploded, he says, but thankfully no one was hurt. Finally, on a hot July day in 2017, Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi declared Mosul liberated. Men danced in the streets. Women handed out candies. It's now been 3 years since the liberation. In that time, Iraq received more than $30 billion in pledges from international donors to rebuild. But Abdullah says reconstruction has been slow. Some schools have reopened, including the University of Mosul, where he's now studying English. When the coronavirus pandemic hit earlier this year, classes went online. But this is a city that has no reliable electricity or internet service.
Oh my God, don't get me started. I mean, the internet here really sucks.
24-year-old Mohammed Mohannad studies English translation at the University of Mosul.
Like 2 days ago, my friend was having an exam, and that exam was postponed 3 times.
The internet kept going down, and when it came back up, the power went out. One man says there were other challenges too. Most students are just not used to online learning.
Like some just don't know how to upload a file, or how to make a Word document and then upload it into the Google Classroom.
And there's always that person, he says, who can't find the mute button. It's not like the teachers had it much easier, says Ali Al-Baroudi. He teaches English at the university.
I cannot exaggerate and say that online learning is or was quite successful. However, there was no plan B.
As the pandemic went on for weeks, Barudi says he noticed a few of his good students not showing up for classes. When he asked around, he learned that's because they can't afford laptops and internet service.
The lockdown continued for weeks here in Mosul, and the daily wagers are deprived of their daily income. So what do we expect? We expect that these people are going to reduce their expenditure. And internet could be the first victim, no matter how much important it is for education.
Iraq's economy is struggling. Coronavirus cases are on the rise, while oil prices have fallen more than 55% since the start of the year. As a result, many Iraqis are struggling to make ends meet.
Hello? It was a power cut. It happened a lot, in just like our conversation.
After I reconnect with Abdullah Thayer in Mosul for the third time, he tells me he's worried about how the power cuts and the internet outages will affect his studies.
Yeah, so our exams next week, and I don't see how they will solve this problem.
Abdullah and millions of young Iraqis missed out on years of education because of the Islamic State. He says they can't afford to lose more time. Abdullah says his final exam this semester will be 2 hours long, and the only thing he can do is to keep his fingers crossed that the power doesn't go out. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Tomorrow on The World, a new film about the Iraq War told by Iraqis who lived through it.
Right after the invasion, one of the very few jobs that you can do in Iraq is to work as a translator. I was ready to work for a dollar. And they were like, would $50 be okay? 50 bucks was my dad's salary for 6 months. I was making it in a day.
Before the Sunni uprising, before ISIS, before the years of chaos and tragedy, there was a time of hope. Iraqis talk about what their lives were like before the 2003 invasion and how the war changed them and their country. The film, Once Upon a Time in Iraq. We meet the director tomorrow on The World. It was the slimmest presidential victory in Poland since the end of communism in 1989. But last night, Poland's incumbent president, Andrzej Duda, narrowly won re-election with 51.2% of the vote. Duda fought a divisive campaign. He promised to bring back family values at the expense of gay rights. Magda Dropek is an LGBT activist and Krakow. Magda, how are you feeling today?
It's a very, very difficult day today for us, especially for the LGBT community in Poland. I feel sad. I'm a bit afraid about the future because it's still uncertain here when it comes to not only to our community, but also state of democracy. But I'm also trying always to be an optimist, so I'm not losing hope. And I'm trying to support also my community in this and to convince them to don't lose hope.
What specifically did Duda say about the LGBT community and gay rights in his campaign?
A few weeks ago, Andrzej Duda said that we are not human beings, we are an ideology. And of course, his words were like the beginning of very homophobic discourse of many people here, also of the politicians of the ruling party.
Is Duda proposing certain legislation, certain bans, certain direct attacks on the LGBT community for his new presidency?
Yes. In his campaign also, he proposed, for example, a ban when it comes to adoption, and he wanted to sign it into the Polish constitution.
Meaning?
Because we have to remember that in Poland, we don't have civil partnerships, we don't have marriage equality. So to be honest, we also don't have adoption. But it was, you know, it was some kind of move from him to show that he wants to defend the traditional family.
He will make it impossible for gay couples to adopt children.
Yes, yes.
Do you think that Duda was going after the LGBT community for campaign reasons to get reelected, but in the end he'll move on to other issues as president, or do you think he's serious?
It's one of my hopes when it comes to Polish politics that after elections now it will be like calmer when it comes to LGBT issues. So we will see. We have to remember that in 2015, when Law and Justice was also building their campaign on a hate but against refugees, especially that it was a refugee crisis in Europe. Last year, before the European Parliament elections, they put spotlight on LGBT community because it it's always easier to build politics on fear and hate against a group of people, especially minority. It's always more difficult to build politics on something positive, especially when we are facing a crisis now.
What do you think is going to be the impact for the LGBT community going forward in Poland?
It's really difficult to say now. I worry about our LGBT youth, especially now after a few months of lockdown, because very often young people were locked at homes with not accepting families. So now, after not having support, they are like hear from the politicians, who rule, that they are not part of society, that they are not human beings. And I worry about their well-being and their mental health. It will be difficult for us to organize and to do activism, of course, especially that I'm afraid also that maybe after those elections, law and justice might feel power to, for example, attack independent media and also non-governmental organizations. But I think that we have to survive this as we survived the last years.
Magda, you're an activist in Krakow. Do you feel safe there?
Yes. I'm privileged to live in a big city, quite diverse, quite open, famous because of tourism. But yes, it started to happen even in Krakow that I hear names because of the fact that I have like a rainbow bag or rainbow pin to show solidarity and support in public with my community. Last week, there was a group of people who were beaten in front of the gay club in Krakow because they were wearing colorful clothes. So I feel safe, but I have in my mind that we should be careful now.
Do you ever think of leaving Poland?
Yes. Yes, unfortunately, yes. And I see that a lot of my friends think about this also. I will do anything to don't have to leave. And I'm trying always to convince my friends, for example, who are thinking about leaving, that if they will leave, there will be no one to change the country. But I understand people that we have only one life, and it's good to live in a country where politicians like think about the fact that you have a right to feel safe, you have a right to dignity, you have a right to respect and to plan your life.
Magda Dropek is an LGBT activist in Krakow, Poland. Thanks a lot, Magda.
Thank you.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau apologized today for the way he handled a student jobs program. As we reported last week, Trudeau is facing an ethics investigation over this, his third. It's connected to a decision by Trudeau's cabinet to give a big government contract to a charity that's connected to his family.
I made a mistake and not recusing myself immediately from the discussions, given our family's history. And I'm sincerely sorry about not having done that.
This was a $900 million deal with We Charity, a group that Trudeau's wife, brother, and mother have all worked for. The new program was supposed to help fund a summer jobs program for students during the pandemic. The contract has now been terminated. Trudeau expressed remorse that his involvement has created unnecessary controversy.
It also means that young people who are facing a difficult time right now, getting summer jobs, contributing to their communities, are going to have to wait a little longer before getting those opportunities to serve.
You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. People of color have been fighting to diversify America's diplomatic ranks for decades. Under Obama, they were 9% of the State Department. Now it's down to 3%. Many African Americans who do get State Department postings say they encounter racial discrimination on a daily basis.
I felt that I should be treated just like the rest of my colleagues that were white and that were never questioned when they crossed the border.
That's Tiana Spears. She's African American. Spears worked processing visas at the American consulate in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, in 2018. She says she was racially profiled dozens of times by U.S. border officials who pulled her over for extensive questioning when she would travel across the border to spend time in El Paso, Texas.
As soon as I started crossing the border regularly, I experienced this harassment. I was threatened. I was constantly asked if I was really a U.S. citizen. They questioned if I stole my car, if my car was a rental. They accused me of being a liar, a drug dealer. Every time I told them I worked as a U.S. diplomat, they laughed at me. They told me they didn't believe me. It was just harassment and bullying on a racial level.
And were you often crossing the border over the U.S. border and encountering the same officials over and over?
Yes, it was the same officials. I began to realize that they recognized my car. and they also recognized me.
And how did you respond? Did you call them on their behavior?
So at first I went along with it because, mind you, at this time I was 26 years old. This was my first job. I was making my family and my community proud. So I just went along with it. It took me a while to really sit down and come to terms with what was happening.
And did you talk about what was happening to you with people at the State Department?
So when I first started crossing the border, you pull up to primary inspection, and this is with U.S. officials for U.S. Customs and Border Protection. So I pulled up to primary, and you're normally questioned. If they have any doubt or they want to search you further, they pull you over to secondary inspection. My colleagues that were people of color, they had also been pulled to secondary, but my white colleagues didn't know what secondary inspection was. I had a few that had lived there for 2-3 years in Juarez and had never been pulled, and they crossed just as much as I did.
And tell me what happens at secondary.
In Juarez, at the border crossing I was crossing over, they pull you over to the left side, and you have to turn your car off. In my case, they would always place my car keys, passports, and my ID on top of the windshield, and I would have to sit on a metal bench while they search my car. I know that that's something that CBP has every right to inspect officers, but I was harassed. It was to the point where anytime I would cross the border, my hands would shake, and I had to actually talk myself into getting into my car.
You mentioned CBPS, that's the Customs and Border Protection Services?
Yes, that's them.
When you complained to the State Department about what was going on, what was their response?
So I spoke to two white regional and assistant security officers that are in charge of protecting us at posts and at the consulate in Juarez. And I explained my case. I explained how I was harassed, and I was met with gaslighting and denial. And in my case, essentially the response was, it's not race discrimination.
So were any actions taken by the State Department that you know of?
I met with the head of upper management, explained my case, but to this day, I have never heard anything about a conclusion or if the officers involved were disciplined. I've never heard back from the State Department or CBP.
And what kind of feedback did you get when you would speak to other colleagues of color about their own experiences?
Other colleagues of color had told me that this had happened before. And, you know, you either have a choice, it seems like, within the State Department's hostile and racist environment. It's either you just go along with the plan, you can keep your job and your financial security and your career trajectory, or you can, you know, speak out.
What made you finally decide to resign?
First of all, I would not say that I resigned from the job. I strongly believe that I was forced out.
Really?
Nothing was done in my case. The Juarez management decided to transfer me to Mexico City, which is far, far from the U.S. border. But at that point, the damage had been done. And it became clear to the point where I just had to choose my own peace of mind and that the State Department wasn't going to protect me or any other person of color. And since coming forward, I've learned that these are not isolated incidences. The State Department knows about this harassment and has known for years and has decided not to do anything about it. They hope that we're silent and we don't say anything and come forward. But I truly believe enough is enough. Something has to be done.
What are your observations about the State Department in terms of why it appears to you to not care about this issue? Is there issues around the culture of the State Department or the Foreign Service? What did you observe that makes you feel this way?
It's a hostile, racist environment.
How does that express itself?
You look around and you don't see anyone who comes in the door that's people of color that are, you know, that are being hired. You don't see people of color that are promoted. And we're definitely not retained. It's just this environment where the State Department caters to that phrase, pale, male, and Yale. That's the foundation that it's been built on.
What do you think it would mean to U.S. diplomatic efforts if the diplomatic corps looked more like America looks?
America loses, first of all, when we're not an inclusive society and when we're not welcoming to others. But secondly, when we're overseas at our embassies and consulates abroad, we have a great opportunity to advance diplomacy and show what America truly represents.
How could the State Department reimagine recruitment and bolster retention of diverse staff and diplomats?
So right now there are two fellowship programs that hire people of color and give them positions within the Foreign Service. I'd say that the State Department needs to increase fellowship programs like this. They need to increase hiring of people of color, promoting entry-level officers and mid-level officers so that they actually have the opportunity to sit at the table and make decisions within these rooms and within the embassies and consulates. So the entire State Department has to look within and see what they can do to make the culture safer, healthier for people of color that come in and give their lives and their careers and their families to its mission. But also just overall, speaking to my own personal experience, I would still be a Foreign Service officer if I felt that they cared about me and they protected me.
Tiana Spears is a former U.S. Foreign Service officer. Thanks a lot for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
A Customs and Border Protection spokesperson told The World that the agency conducted an internal investigation last year. They found no evidence to substantiate Tiana Spears' allegations of racial discrimination, harassment, or unfair detainment at the port of entry, and that its agents acted appropriately. In a separate statement, State Department officials told The World that they take Spears' allegations very seriously and that they are working with CBP to improve the experience of our personnel at the border and cooperation between the officers of the two agencies. The surge in coronavirus cases around the world are a reminder of the urgent need for more testing. But those who can get a test sometimes have to wait days for a result. Join us live tomorrow at 12 noon Eastern for a conversation with epidemiologist Michael Minna on the latest advances in testing. What questions do you have? Email us at myworld@theworld.org and stream the conversation live at theworld.org. Washington, D.C.'s football team is changing its name. Will other teams follow suit?
I think that people now might go, oh, well, if Washington have finally decided to do it, maybe it's time for the rest of us to do it as well.
The global push to get racial stereotypes out of official sports branding. Up soon on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of WGBH in Boston and PRX. A small crowd gathered outside of Turkey's most iconic building for the call to prayer on Friday. Prayers have been broadcast from the Hagia Sophia for several years, but this time it had extra meaning after the announcement that the building would be converted back into a mosque. The Hagia Sophia was built as a Christian cathedral nearly 1,500 years ago. It was converted to a mosque after the Ottoman conquest of 1453. For the past 86 years, it's been a museum. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says in less than 2 weeks, it will open again for Muslim prayers. Erdogan's push to refashion the landmark has been strongly criticized.
Il mare mi porta un po' lontano il pensiero a Istanbul.
Yesterday at the Vatican's Sunday prayers, Pope Francis said he is deeply saddened by Turkey's decision. The building has been seen as a place where cultures coexist, a landmark where East meets West. In Turkey, there's another East-West clash taking place on a much smaller scale involving a 28-year-old Iranian parkour athlete. Parkour is a sport where athletes turn the urban environment around them into an obstacle course. The young man found himself arrested in Iran for posting a video of himself and his girlfriend kissing. He fled to Turkey, but was picked up again. Now, human rights advocates worry that he'll be extradited back to the Islamic Republic, where similar cases have been met with a death sentence. Duri Buskarin reports from Istanbul.
Alireza Japalagi's videos are a virtual tour of Iran's urban landscapes and ancient sites as he flips over buildings and free hangs on apartment blocks, all to a house music soundtrack.
Ready?
At one point, he climbs up the spire of a commuter bridge. He's like a character in a video game come to life. And then there was this clip, posted in May, called Sunrise in Tehran. It's just 44 seconds. Japalagi and an unidentified woman are shown kissing in front of the city skyline, on a rooftop, and while hanging off of a building. He's shirtless, She's wearing a sports bra, her ponytail pulled through the loop of a baseball hat. But this is Iran. It's against public decency codes for women to be in public without a hijab, even on social media. So are public displays of affection between unmarried people, says Tara Saperi-Farr of Human Rights Watch.
One of the biggest problems with Iran's public decency laws is that they're intentionally vaguely defined and open to interpretation.
Interpretation by police, by judges, and this haphazard style of enforcement can make it hard to predict what will land you in jail, Saperi-Farr says. Sometimes people are targeted because they happened to attract too much attention. That may have been the story of Jabalaki and his partner, who were arrested shortly after the video was posted.
Authorities are aware of the power of social media, and they're worried that losing this battle would ultimately mean more concessions.
Jabalaki and his partner are among many Iranian social media influencers who have run into trouble, Saperi-Farr explains. Women who post pictures of themselves without a headscarf or dancing in their bedrooms. Influencers promoting a lifestyle that is seen by the authorities as against Islamic moral codes. There have always been young Iranians who rebel against the government's interpretation of how Islam should be practiced, Saperi-Farr explains. But in the past, it was private.
They had to hold their parties or however they wanted to dress indoor behind closed doors. Now social media allows you to see what's going on behind those doors.
After his arrest in Iran, Jabalaki was released on bail and left for Turkey. But that's when he was detained again, this time by Turkish police. He posted a video from a police van and shared it to social media. I don't know where they're taking me, he says. I'm sitting in the car with some policemen. Reports by independent Iranian journalists indicate that Jabalaki is being detained near Van, a city close to Turkey's border with Iran. Now, human rights advocates are worried that he may be deported back to Iran.
I mean, it's concerning. If he's in Turkey...
Turkey is generally seen as a safe haven for Iranians fleeing the regime, or at least a pass-through point. But Sina Tusi, an analyst for the National Iranian American Council, points to two young Iranians who tried to seek asylum in Turkey after participating in popular protests in Iran, sparked by rising gas prices last November.
They wanted to request political asylum in Turkey. And they were in a taxi, evidently, and then the taxi driver, for whatever reason, turned them into the Turkish authorities, turned them into the police.
These details were reported last month by the Human Rights Activist News Agency, an Iranian civil society group. The protesters were then deported back to Iran, where they've been handed death sentences by the country's highest court. Moin Kanzeli, an Iranian legal scholar now living in Sweden, worries that Jabalaki could be extradited too.
Recently, like 3-4 years, Iranian refugees have had more problems with authorities in Turkey than before.
Turkey's president Recep Tayyip Erdogan styles himself as a protector of refugees. Turkey hosts more asylum seekers than any other country in the world. In speeches, Erdogan says deportations are only in the interest of national security. But Kanzeli thinks there's more to it, that the two countries are growing closer ideologically.
Turkey and Iran has hidden interest that Turkey would cooperate with Iran in these kind of issues.
One thing seems clear. Iran's government considers social media a serious threat, so much so that they're willing to pursue Jabalaki and other internet celebrities beyond the country's borders. For the world, I'm Derry Buscarin in Istanbul.
Iran and China. The two nations have been central to the Trump administration's approach to foreign policy. In the case of Iran, that approach has involved robust sanctions. And when it comes to China, a prolonged trade war and a simmering tit-for-tat rivalry. Now there's news that Iran and China are close to signing a new partnership deal to increase economic and security cooperation between the two nations. So what could it mean for the U.S.? Esfandiar Batmanghelidj is the founder of Bourse and Bazaar, and he's an expert on Iran's economy. He joins us now from London. Esfandiar, what does Iran get out of this deal?
Well, Iran will hope to get from China something that it's been pursuing for a very long time, and something that really all the countries in the Middle East have been pursuing, which is a much clearer framework for bilateral relations with China. China has become the hegemon of Asia and a major contributor to the economies of the Middle East, including Iran. But there hasn't really been a clear understanding of what the political relationship is going to look like between Iran and China. In 2016, President Rouhani traveled to Beijing and signed a basic partnership agreement, but that was never built into a larger and more comprehensive deal. And really, the deal that's being discussed now is a continuation of that negotiation process. It's not really a response specifically to the Trump administration's maximum pressure campaign.
But what does Iran literally get out of the deal? Are there specifics, you know, ports, you know, transportation networks? What do they get?
There's been a document that's been circulating on Iranian social media that is purportedly a draft of kind of the negotiating points that Iran will seek to raise with Beijing. And there are around 100 projects or so listed there that include Chinese investment in different kinds of infrastructure like ports and airports, and also more investment in the country's oil sector.
So what does China get out of it?
Well, China is at a crossroads because they need to figure out how they are going to balance their own relationships, particularly with Middle Eastern countries, because over the last several decades, China has benefited from the U.S. security architecture. It was U.S. troops in the Middle East that basically made it safe for oil exports to flow freely from the Persian Gulf to China and to really supply China's incredible economic boom. But now that the U.S. is more an out-and-out rival with China, and also because of continued talk about U.S. withdrawal from the Middle East, China needs to decide how much it's going to invest in the security architecture in the region, and a deal with Iran is going to be a critical part of that.
What might security cooperation between Iran and China look like?
Well, I think this is one of the areas where there's been a lot of kind of sensational headlines and a lot of concern. I think we should keep in mind that that security cooperation is going to be very limited at the beginning. And there are a few reasons for this. The first is that China doesn't really have experience of significant security cooperation anywhere in the world. And they're really just now coming to grips with understanding how much they're going to engage and how much that engagement might actually make the tensions with the U.S. worse, which I think is something that they would wish to avoid. It's also going to be limited because there's a lot of sensitivity in Iran to sacrificing sovereignty or becoming too dependent on China, whether economically or from a security standpoint. And we can actually look to the case of Russia-Iran security cooperation over the last several years as an example of how limited that cooperation is likely to be with China. The idea that China is going to arm Iran to the hilt and use Iran as a kind of proxy in its rivalry with the U.S., I think is completely overblown.
Should we interpret this as somehow the result of the Trump administration's maximum pressure campaign effectively forcing Iran into the arms of China?
I think Iran was always going to have such a deal with China. China's the rising economic power. So it's not a unique feature of the U.S. rivalry or U.S. pressure on Iran. However, what I think the Trump administration has sacrificed, and this is really important, is that the U.S. was in a position to balance out Iran's growing relationship with China by actually making good on the nuclear deal that was came into force in 2016 under President Obama. And the product of that nuclear deal was a significant increase in Western investment in Iran's economy. Now, we're at a position where, because the U.S. has reimposed sanctions, Iran can't reasonably grow its trade relationship with Europe, although I think it would absolutely want to. And so in some ways, more growth from China is about compensating for that closed door to the West. Often people say that Iran is at the center of China's ambitions, but in reality, China is at the center of the economic development plans of pretty much every country at the same level of development as Iran. So we shouldn't overcharacterize the extent to which this is a direct threat to the U.S.
Asfandyar Bhatmangalich is the founder of Bourse and Bazaar, and he's an expert on Iran's economy. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
The United Nations and African Union have added their voices condemning the government in Mali. The West African country has seen large anti-government demonstrations in recent days. Protesters are calling for Mali's president to resign. Government forces reportedly fired toward protesters over the weekend, killing several people. The World's Halima Gakandi brings us the story.
The demonstrations have been on and off for the past month in Mali's capital, Bamako. But on Friday, things came to a head again. A group of opposition politicians, activists, and religious leaders called for civil disobedience. Videos posted online show people holding signs demanding President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita step down. Even the famous Malian Afropop singer Salif Keita chimed in. He released a video on Twitter. Dressed in military fatigues, Keita said Mali is in a bad place and people are suffering. The protesters' grievances are many, says Nadia Adam. She's a researcher at the Institute for Security Studies, and she's based in Bamako.
General dissatisfaction related to the deterioration of the security situation in the country and also the rough management of the health crisis.
The security situation is about the Malian government not being able to end the violence carried out by terrorist groups. Attacks have killed thousands of civilians in Mali and in neighboring countries. More than 900,000 people have fled their homes. As for the coronavirus, more than 100 people have died from COVID-19 so far. But protesters also have problems with the presence of foreign troops, as well as the government's harsh counterterrorism response. On Friday, Amnesty International accused Mali's military of killing civilians earlier this year.
Situation socio-politique après l'adresse à la nation du président de la République.
Protesters in Bamako briefly occupied the state media building. The station has since resumed operations. Over the weekend, President Keita addressed the public in Mali. He called for an end to the unrest.
J'ai donc décidé d'abroger le décret de nomination des membres restants de la cour.
Keita said he would dissolve the country's constitutional courts. The courts have been another focus of the protests because they overturned the results of contested parliamentary elections that took place earlier this year. Keita also made other promises.
The president has proposed a political agreement and the formation of a government of national unity.
But Adam says those concessions don't seem to be enough for protesters who want to see their president step down. More protests continued in Bamako today. Adam says major roads have remained blocked, and she tells me that she could hear gunshots from outside her home. For The World, I'm Halima Gakandi.
South Africa is mourning the loss of one of its anti-apartheid leaders. Zindzi Mandela died this morning at the age of 59. She was the daughter of South African icons Nelson Mandela and Winnie Madikizela Mandela. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa said today, "We mourn the passing of a fearless political activist who was a leader in her own right." Zindzi Mandela grew up during the height of her country's anti-apartheid struggles. She was 18 months old when her father was sent to prison. She didn't see him again until she was 15 years old. Mandela's youngest daughter rose to prominence in 1985 when she read a letter from her father rejecting an offer of conditional freedom.
"My father says, I cannot and will not give any undertaking at a time when I and you, the people, are not free. Your freedom and mine cannot be separated."
Archbishop Desmond Tutu said that speech on her father's behalf reinvigorated the values and principles of the struggle. In 2008, Zindzi Mandela told Al Jazeera that it was difficult to grow up as the daughter of two icons.
"You know, it takes a lot for people to actually see you for yourself. You are never seen like for yourself. So you have to work twice as hard to make your own star shine."
Zindzi Mandela rose to become South Africa's ambassador to Denmark, a post she was currently holding. She died in a hospital in Johannesburg today. The cause of her death was not immediately revealed. She's survived by her husband and four children. Since the police killing of George Floyd in Minnesota, the world has been reckoning with racist symbols in a lot of different ways. Statues have been toppled, executives have been stripped of their titles, and now the calls for racial equity are coming to sports. Here's The World's Bianca Hillier.
For years, Indigenous activists have been demanding that sports teams around the world retire the use of racial slurs and imagery in their names and logos. Today, Washington's NFL team is taking the first step.
We want to turn now to some major news out of the NFL. Washington's NFL team retiring its controversial nickname.
The name is controversial and is getting nixed by the team because it's a racial slur, one that we will not be saying on air. Tristan Ottone, president of the Native American Journalists Association and member of the Kiowa Tribe of Oklahoma, says there are a number of reasons why it's important to retire the name from our conversations.
One of the, I think, the most obvious ones is that it's just unethical to be using a racial slur. As an Indigenous person, it's hurtful. And no matter what Indigenous organizations, tribal nations, et cetera, say about this topic, non-Indigenous people don't seem to want to listen.
Ottone says Washington's announcement is an important one, but he's skeptical about the team's motivation.
The area that frustrates me is that, you know, we're seeing this change happen because there's been financial pressure. It's not definitely not out of the goodness of their heart.
It's true. Today's announcement comes after sponsors including FedEx, PepsiCo, Nike, and Bank of America said they would cut ties with the team if they didn't replace their name. A football team up in Canada is facing the same pressure. Two sponsors of the Edmonton Eskimos say they want the team to change its name. In response, the team promised last week to expedite a review of the name, with an update expected by the end of July. It's a dialogue encouraged by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau.
This is a discussion and a reflection that the city of Edmonton certainly needs to undertake. Reconciliation is not just about Indigenous people and the government. It's about all of us as Canadians, non-Indigenous as well. And I think that's a really important discussion to have.
The discussion is also taking place in the UK around the Exeter Chiefs Rugby Club. In the past 2 weeks, nearly 3,000 people have signed a petition led by the campaign Exeter Chiefs for Change. A spokesperson for the campaign said they're asking for an overhaul of the team's imagery.
Their logo is a cartoon of a Native American chief wearing the headdress. And also the bars at their grounds and everything are kind of named on that theme. So you've got like the teepee hut and things like that. So it's very much ingrained in their branding.
The spokesperson asked to represent the campaign as a whole and for us to not use her name. She says she's not expecting Exeter's team to change anytime soon. But she thinks Washington's announcement today could provide momentum for an international movement.
I think because they were almost like the ones who were ignoring everything and refusing to change, the fact that they have now changed, I think that people now might go, oh, well, if Washington have finally decided to do it, maybe it's the time for the rest of us to do it as well.
Washington's NFL team has not yet announced their new name. It's reportedly tied up in a trademark conflict. Tristan Ottone says he's waiting for that information.
You know, until we actually see what that replacement is, I think it's probably too early for us to be celebrating. The team could still come back with, like, Native-themed imagery.
The team does continue to use its original name. Today's announcement was released on unchanged letterhead from the team's official Twitter account, whose handle includes the racial slur. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The National Hockey League is back on the ice today.
Hockey is back.
That's the NHL's new promotional video, Better Days Are Coming. Teams are practicing today for the first time since March. Games are scheduled to resume August 1st.
Really looking forward to get back on the ice.
Games will not be held in the United States. The NHL is holding its 24-team playoff in two Canadian cities, Edmonton and Toronto. Edmonton will host the 2020 Stanley Cup Finals. That city has reported only about 200 cases of COVID-19. The entire nation of Canada has recorded 110,000 infections since the outbreak began. That's about what the United States reported last weekend alone. NHL games in Canada will have no fans, but a lot of uncertainty. For example, what happens if a player tests positive for the virus?
One positive test shouldn't shut down the tournament.
NHL Deputy Commissioner Bill Daly says player safety is paramount. And if there's an outbreak?
There's no hard and fast numbers on that. That's more a sense of the medical professionals, and we'll take our lead from them.
A lot of hypotheticals. For example, if an outbreak rips through the Boston Bruins locker room, do they postpone Boston's games for 2 weeks? NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman says the league is switching from one grind to another by moving operations to two Canadian cities.
Making sure the testing and the protocols are adhered to.
Getting back on the ice, Bettman says, is not the beginning of the end for this pandemic NHL season. It's the end of the beginning. Here's a story that's near and dear to the hearts of us radio folks. When it comes to monitoring and protecting the world's ecosystems, some scientists say the most powerful tool could one day be the audio recorder. The world's Anna Kusmer has more.
Sarab Seti's favorite sound in nature comes around dusk in a rainforest in Southeast Asia.
It's a forest elephant trumpeting in the middle of a Borneo forest, which doesn't get more romantic than that, really.
Seti is a researcher at Imperial College London. He thinks collecting sound could revolutionize the way that nature is monitored and protected.
So many animals make sound, right? You've got the birds, frogs, insects, and everything in between. And it just has a huge amount of information.
Since 2016, Seti and his team have collected thousands of hours of recordings to document the soundscapes around the world. Those new recordings and the ways Seti's team used machine learning to analyze them were published in the Journal of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences this month. In Borneo, they captured old-growth rainforests and protected areas next to rivers, and also disturbed ecosystems like oil palm plantations. The recordings may sound similar to the untrained ear, but to scientists, they contain a treasure trove of data. Ecologists have used sound recordings for years to monitor individual species.
But the approach that we took was a bit different. It was to say, take 5 minutes of audio and just characterize it as a fingerprint. Don't try and break it down into a specific species.
Seti says once a fingerprint is established for a region, monitors could be used to detect changes to that fingerprint over time, changes that could indicate illegal logging or poachers in the area. Seti says an unexpected effect of the research is he's started noticing the sounds of nature everywhere he goes, even in his backyard in London. For The World, I'm Anna Kusmer.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. See you back here tomorrow.